Would you like to learn more about the formula for successful growth businesses to develop differentiating and unwavering principles and mechanisms to implement those winning principles again and again? John Rossman is here with some very original insights.
This is the Economics for Entrepreneurs podcast, a project of the Mises Institute, applying the principles of economics to start, grow, and manage your business. For free tools, resources, key takeaways, and actionable insights from each episode, visit Mises.org/E4EPod. Now, here's Hunter Hastings.
Hi, Hunter Hastings here. Today we're talking about principles and mechanisms. Specifically, the establishment of the few principles that will drive your growing business, about the culture of your firm to act unwaveringly on those principles, and, very importantly, the mechanisms you can build to ensure that your principles are operationalized and can be executed again and again and again whenever the circumstances are appropriate. It's a formula for growth that some of the greatest businesses have applied. Principles are the small number of standards or rules or ways of doing things that become the bedrock of the firm. Amazon famously has 14 leadership principles, beginning with customer obsession. It's a way of thinking, a standard approach, a high bar always to be emulated, always asking in whatever project you're working on, have I or my team obsessed sufficiently about the customer? Do I truly know what they want, how they feel, what frictions they're experiencing, what they wish for? Is there a way to get more information, to get closer, to interpret their signals more accurately, with greater empathy? That's obsession. Different companies can utilize similar principles in their own way. At Procter & Gamble, the same principle of customer obsession is expressed in the phrase, "the customer is boss." This principle ensures that the customer's decision is final on matters of product features, quality, and pricing. The principle ensures that consumer testing is conducted frequently, early, intensely, scientifically. Customer feedback is paramount when the customer is the boss. In Austrian economics, the principle is expressed as consumer sovereignty. It's the same principle as Amazon's obsession or P&G's the customer is the boss. Our goal at Economics for Entrepreneurs is to illustrate all the principles of economics for business that can help your business and give examples and bring them to life. There's a necessary corollary to business principles, as John Rossman, our guest today, explains. For the principles to make an impact and bring you business success, they must be operationalized. They can't just be sayings. They're not a poster, as John puts it. They must be put into action, again and again, by multiple teams on multiple projects across the whole organization and throughout time. John calls the second part of this duality mechanisms. These are mapped out processes for executing principles every time it's appropriate to do so, in every relevant business situation. With mechanisms in place, you can be sure that the principles you establish to guide your business are going to be implemented without variance. You can imbue the principles into your employees and teams and vendors and partners and train them in the mechanisms and be confident in the outcomes. Your business becomes a growth machine. Let's have John Rossman tell us more. John is a high-level advisor to CEOs and C-suites in some of the greatest global businesses of our time. Not only businesses, but also the great institutions like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. His resume includes leading the creation of the third-party seller platform at Amazon. And it was there that he was able to observe and contribute to the system of principles and mechanisms in action. He hinted at that in titling his book, Think Like Amazon. John, welcome to Economics for Entrepreneurs.
Hunter, thank you for welcoming me.
Well, it's great to have you here. You're a top-level advisor helping CEOs and C-suites compete in the digital era. You say it takes new digital business models, new capabilities, a new playbook. So we're going to learn a lot from you today. Thank you very much.
Absolutely.
And just so that our listeners understand, one of the things you've done in a long and distinguished career is launch the third-party selling platform at Amazon. So you probably helped a lot of our listeners become successful entrepreneurs. So
I love to hear stories about people who've used that platform as an entrepreneur to, you know, build a new product, change their vocation, and have success with it.
Well, good. Well, the world thanks you, I think. And you also wrote a great book, which I love, called Think Like Amazon, 50 and a half ideas to become a digital leader. And I found it a tremendously useful book. I read the ideas. I keep it handy. In a break, I go back to it and I think about it. You're not just talking about ideas, but you process them and put them in this context of the new digital world. So for anybody who hasn't read that, it's tremendously useful.
Well, thanks. You know, I wrote that book. You know, I was at Amazon from early 2002 to late 2005, so about 4 years. And then I had the advantage of being a partner in a consulting firm, working with a number of great companies. I did over 80 projects with the Gates Foundation, and I just got into a lab environment where I was taking the little strategies, the little approaches of how we got things done at Amazon and putting them in place to help create change happen. And it was through that playground, that lab, that I got to recognize kind of the power and to tune them and to recognize that, you know, you can't put all 50 in play at once. You have to realize the two or three. You have to really commit both personally and as a team to going about some different approaches to get different results. And so several years after I left Amazon, I came to this and one of my real business partner on this is a guy by the name of Greg Shaw. Greg is the author of Satya Nadella's book, Hit Refresh. He just wrote a book for Kevin Scott, who's the CTO at Microsoft, the co-author on that book. And Greg was my client when he was at the Gates Foundation. And he's the one who really encouraged me, like, hey, you know, you should codify this. You should force yourself to write it down. And I've just had so much fun, and it's been hard, and actually going through the process of forcing myself to write these things out in completeness with a storyline behind it that helps an audience recognize the different approaches that you can take to help make change and innovation and operational excellence happen.
Fantastic. So let's seize on one word that you used there, and that's the word innovation. And you talk about how important it is to every business. We're sometimes accused here of spending too much time in innovation and not on other subjects. And I always say that innovation is management. So tell me what your experience and your philosophy is about innovation, given all the background and projects and Amazon experience you just described.
Well, so after I left Amazon, I was a partner at a really great firm called Alvarez & Marsal. Alvarez & Marsal, its heritage is restructuring, so dealing with crisis situations and client situations. And what I came to realize is that all management teams, all executives, like, they talk about the desire to innovate and to want to change and to make bets and to continue to try new things. But the hardest thing in the world to do is for a successful company to truly do that. What they typically tend to do is optimize for short term. And in working with clients in crisis, those became my favorite situations because they were willing to let go of the past. They were willing to do anything. They were really willing to rethink every premise of their business and industry. And I had so many healthy clients who said they wanted to create change, who said they wanted to innovate, who said they, you know, wanted to fail fast and be tolerant and all these admirable concepts. But the short-term thinking and the short-term profit motive just gets in the way in that. And I think that fabric, that environment that successful enterprises operate in, they have to recognize that is the biggest deterrent. Their current success is their biggest deterrent towards creating the future. And I truly believe that the biggest long-term risk that most successful companies face today is that they aren't placing enough future bets, small, discrete, individual ideas, bets on the future, and being systematic in about how they test those, how they incubate them, how they decide to go forward with them or not go forward with them, that they aren't deliberate about that. And so the major thesis, I guess I would have about innovation is that you have to be systematic about it, and you have to recognize that it's a different approach to going about your work. And it's different than when you are at scale and operating well. Those types of things you do there are typically the exact wrong types of things you want to do in your innovation pipeline. But you know, everybody says they want it. Very few are willing to be planful about it. Very few are willing to deploy the resources on a consistent basis for it. And very few are willing to spend their individual time deep enough to really create change.
You talk about something you call high throughput innovation, John, and it sounds that like that's connected to your idea of make lots of small bets. I think you call it thinking big, but don't bet big.
Yeah, thinking big, but bet small. And what companies can't afford to do is that have big failures. So if you think about what a bet is a smart guess, but you actually don't know what the outcome is, right? You certainly don't understand the final form factor of a service or a product or a new business. Like you can be directionally correct, but there's so many details that you have to get right. And so you have to really, there's a really good book called Thinking in Bets. And it's that complete mindset of making smart guesses, but then doing the little things, the agile approaches, the minimally viable products. All of those concepts are about testing it and improving it and refining it to getting it right before you scale it. And you have to think about this as a portfolio, because so many of these ideas aren't going to work out if they're truly bets. But what do most companies do? They have an idea, they go big early on it, and when it doesn't have the impact that they expect, they retreat from it. They retreat from trying new things. They punish the teams that were involved with it. They do all the wrong reactions to it. And I think that's one of the things that you can take from Amazon, is that they are so comfortable with having things not work out as planned. And that's called, you know, failure. But I think that's a tricky word, because when we're talking about failure in this context, we are talking about scientific testing failure, not failure of execution or failure of being sloppy or failure of being lazy. And so I like to use the terms of, you know, being hypothesis driven or learning process of innovation. So you have to have a portfolio. You have to have a really deliberate way of how do we cultivate ideas? How do we think through ideas? How do we prototype ideas? How do we scale ideas? How do we then launch them and integrate them into our existing businesses or not? All the different pathways of how you take an idea from the very concept through it being a really big new business, that is the idea of high throughput innovation and having a systematic way for innovating.
In that context, John, is innovation and the innovation team and the innovation resources, are they segregated from the daily management and operations of the business, or are they fully integrated? You can't differentiate between the two. What's been your experience there?
My experience is that there's no one right answer to that type of question. It really depends upon the environment and how things work. I've seen it work both ways, and I've seen it fail in every possible way. And I think it's really much more about how you go about the work than how you think about the separations of the teams. I do have a default that I think is the best, but again, it's not, it doesn't guarantee success. I like separated, obsessed, fully focused small teams, but you want to have them physically proximal to the rest of the organization. I think too much distance creates too many challenges around culture and access and not knowing each other well enough, and some animosity and jealousy can build up and everything, right? And so I think you do need to have a small, fully committed teams. You can have matrixed in participants that aren't full-time, but, you know, obsession does breed a completely different type of results and approach and speed in this. And so one way, like however you organize it, having dedicated, fully committed small teams, I do think is typically the right approach. But again, the answer to your question is it depends.
We're talking with John Rossmann about principles and mechanisms. For our Austrian principle of customer sovereignty, we developed a mechanism we call understanding the mind of the customer. You can get it in the form of a free downloadable ebook at e4epod.com/mind. That's the letter E, the number 4, letter E, pod.com/mind. Enjoy. And now back to our conversation. Okay, well, that's really helpful. You mentioned barriers to getting innovation done, and you talk in the book about incentives. And, you know, we economists perk up our ears when you talk incentives because we think we know something about that, even if we don't. But you have a really interesting set of incentives that you talk as playfulness and a game, making it fun. Can you tell us about that?
Well, you know, this concept of how to put supports in place, right? So none of these ideas are the single thing you need to do. Unfortunately, it's a lot of different things that you need to do in order to create a culture of systematic innovation. And so one of the things to think through is like, how do we make it a source of pride to be an innovator? How do we make it a source of pride to have a quote unquote failure, to have a systematic learning, right? And so, you know, one of the examples of that is, you know, having patents. And so Amazon has a patent award. And so if you're a person at Amazon and your name is on a patent, guess what your complete economic incentive is? Your complete economic incentive is you get probably a $5 piece of acrylic plastic, looks like a puzzle piece, that says, thank you for being an inventor, signed by Jeff Bezos, even though it's not really signed by Jeff Bezos, right? And on the internal phone tool at Amazon, where people, you know, find you and stuff, next to your name and picture is a little puzzle piece that just shows others, I'm an Amazon inventor. And so it's just this small little message that we recognize, we treasure people who rethink how it goes about. And so even if creating patents is not important to your business, and for 90% of us, it's not, finding ways, authentic ways, long-term ways to visibly recognize people who are doing this correctly is an important support. Again, it's not a singular thing you need to do, but it's one of those subtle things that good organizations do, just like you do in recognizing other types of, you know, whether it's outstanding customer service or, you know, an outstanding operational reward or an outstanding sales incentive award. It's the same type of mindset of, you know, if you want to create pride and recognition in this, you have to find an authentic, systematic way to do it.
And that, so incentives are psychic, they're non-financial, they're about group recognition, that kind of thing.
They can be financial, but I think you have to be very careful and very thoughtful about those. So they can be financial, but they don't have to be, right? I would think of, you know, like, hey, what are the easy early things we can do to help create this culture of innovation? I think those are kind of the supports and the messages and the awards and the, you know, that you can do. I think the 300 or 400 level class on this is like, okay, how do we create economic and compensation based rewards for this? I just wouldn't lead with that. Mm-hmm. Would maybe be my thought on that.
So I'm developing this picture in my mind of this high throughput innovation. It sounds intense. You got lots of small teams working hard, doing their sprints and their scrums and their invention and so on. It sounds like a dense cloud of activity. But you also talk about gaining clarity in the innovation process. And you give an example of one of the divisions in Amazon that launched lots and lots and lots of major new services in a very short period of time. And yet you said they found a clarifying tool to do that. So let's go there, John. Tell us about gaining clarity.
Yeah. So I think, you know, the whole concept is about, you know, starting with the customer or starting with the endpoint you envision and working backwards and trying to do that with as much clarity. And so clarity, I define in the book, I think has really two aspects to it. It's both simplicity of thought plus completeness of thought. And it's easy to have one without the other, but it's actually very hard to have both completeness of thought and simplicity of thought. You know, Mark Twain said, I ran out of time, so instead of writing you a short letter, yeah. I wrote you a mm-hmm. long letter, right? Like it's actually real. It is the hardest type of writing or content development or thinking is to make things simple and complete. But by forcing teams upfront, before you do anything, to start with the endpoint, work backwards with as much clarity, completeness of thought, simplicity of thought as possible. Envision how would it work? Who are the customers? What problems are we solving for that customer? How does the business model work? What are the tough things we have to do in order to do this? What's in scope? What's out of scope? How would we go about testing, refining, developing this? If you go through all of that messy process upfront, before you go into your development cycles, you've gained the power of forcing focused minds to think it through, have conversations that rationalize it, plus by having the discipline of writing these down as narratives. Narratives are fully complete documents that have complete paragraphs, complete sentences, are not abbreviated with snippets of thought, which are called bullet points and PowerPoint slides. They're fully written out. Then you can pass them forward to others, including executives. And you ask the executives to actually play a more important role, is to better digest this, better understand the details of this than you get by having somebody present you with a concept. And then executives digest this. They get to think it through. They get to mull it over, sleep on it, right? And then they can flex their own insights into this idea. Then once you have as good as possible concepts on what is the idea, what is the end state, what is all the messy stuff we need to figure out, then you're going to be able to so much better proceed on it in a very small, very hypothesis-driven, very incremental approach versus if you just have an abstract concept of what it is, then the development process is figuring that out throughout. And that's a very expensive, very slow process to go through. So one of Amazon's championship disciplines is every project, every concept, every idea is written out as a narrative. This is idea 44 in the book called A Narrative About Narratives, Ditch the PowerPoint and Gain Clarity. And it's this go slow to go fast technique of writing out concepts and ideas as narratives before you start on it.
Help us with one thing there, John. You said earlier that you make this bet, you're not sure what the outcome is going to be. Now you're writing a narrative, a six-page, as you say, complete sentence, complete set, paragraph description of where the innovation project is going. How do you handle that that conflict between, I don't know exactly where it's going, but here's the narrative. How does that work?
Well, it's really about like working in the future, right? Which is imagining what the future is. And when you try to imagine the details of like, well, how does a customer use this? How does it integrate? How does it operate? What fails around it? Why are they delighted with it? Why do they love this new thing? Then all you're doing is you're refining, you're doing two things. A, you're refining your definition of what your new product or new service or new business is, and you're recognizing, well, I really don't understand this particular aspect really like very well, right? So you're identifying, oh, maybe I need to test that early. Maybe I need to go out and talk to a customer about that specific topic, or maybe I need to go do competitive research on that refined aspect of it. So it helps you identify what you think the future is, share it better amongst a team so that we're all matching together with our refined understanding of a concept, and it helps you identify what you understand well and what you don't understand well, so that then you can proceed in a very orderly fashion in, well, what do we think the most important thing to test next is, which is what the complete agile and minimally viable product mindset is about, is test in as isolated and as simple a way as possible. What's the most important thing to go figure out next and get some data, get feedback on it? That's the scientific testing process.
You used a term there that we really really resonates for us, and that is about imagining the future. That's what we think entrepreneurs do with all of the challenges about clarity and certainty that you just mentioned. And you have this wonderful tool for imagining the future that you call the future press release. So can you tell us about imagining the future and capturing it in a future press release?
Yeah. So I think after you've done the hard work of trying to write out your narrative, which is more of a complete statement of what you're imagining the future, then you create a lighter weight version of that that's called a future press release. And a future press release is like any press release, it's an announcement, right? And so this announcement is not about the launch of your new product or your new service or your new capability. It's about sometime after launch, once you've achieved success. And you're going to talk about it from the voice of the customer. What delighted your customer about this new product and new service? And you want to try to make it you want to really try to hone in on like, what was the killer feature, the really unique aspect of what you delivered that really made the difference? And you start with that. Then you talk about maybe kind of some of the impact from a business standpoint you've had with this. And then you talk about what were the really hard things, the important things we did along the way to make this happen. And although you haven't done the work yet, it helps a broader organization, a broader set of stakeholders, without having to digest the full narrative, understand this is the journey we are going to go on. And then it's also a leadership enablement tool, because what you do is you say, this one person is the leader for making this future press release happen. And we all work for that person relative to making that vision happen. So it's a way of helping to cut through organization structure, cut through bureaucracy, and to get a mission-oriented organization focused on, we all play a role in delivering against this future. And I think that's one of the hard things in organizations is, you know, cutting across an organization, people understanding well enough what the vision is, what the North Star of what we're delivering, and then enabling a person who may not be a super senior person in the organization, but recognizing like, we work for the mission. We don't work for a role or a person or an organization, right? We're trying to do something for the enterprise. And this person has been given the authority to drive this mission. So in that essence, we all work for that person. And it just helps you be a more nimble, fast-moving, fast decision-making organization.
Yeah. I love that. And in principle, it's a wonderful general tool. I mean, we talk about imagining the future. That's a kind of a theory. It doesn't tell you much. It's practical. And you come up with the future press release, which is a wonderfully practical way to do that. I can write the future. I call it a press release. It's brilliant.
Right. And that's I think, one of the tricks of Amazon's, one of the concepts from Amazon is like having a principle, having a concept, but then what's the mechanism? Like, what's the technique? Mm-hmm. What do you do in order to practice or manifest that concept, right? And so I try as best possible to kind of like, hey, here's the goal, here's the principle behind this, and here's an approach in order to do it, the mechanism in order to do it. You can come up with different mechanisms and achieve the same principle. I'm never tied to that, but at the end of the day, if you know, you got to figure out like, well, am I actually hitting the goals of the principle? You can be a little more flexible on the mechanisms.
Well, John, let's go up one step to an even bigger picture, and that is about what you call being digital. We live in this era of digital business, and you say don't worry about defining it, what is digital, but focus on implementing it, how to do digital. And you have a lot of great tips and information about execution, the organization, the operations, the individual activity of being digital. So let's go there about the idea, especially for an entrepreneur or business owner, about going digital or being digital. Tell us about your context for that.
Yeah. So, you know, there's lots of different ways to think about definitions of, you know, what does being digital mean, right? And those are all good. The way I think about being digital, though, is I really think it's about what we're, again, back to principles. What we're really trying to do is we're trying to compete differently. And I think that the essence of truly digital organizations is really two attributes. And those underlying attributes, although they sound simpler, they are distinctly different attributes. And I use what are typically athletic terms in order to describe those attributes, but we hear about them in businesses too. The first attribute is speed, right? And so when we think about really what speed is about being able to do something very fast, high quality, low cost, very efficiently, right? If you think about a sprinter and speed, it's about having a very refined technique. Well, when you think about that in the business context, what speed is it's about operational excellence, right? It's about executing at scale, with continuous improvement at cost, at quality, at expectations, meeting the customer's need every time. It's about getting to perfection. So the first attribute of competing in the digital era is you have to become world-class at your operations and hitting customer expectations every single time. You will never get there, but that is the journey, right? The second attribute that, again, I state in an athletic term, is agility. So when we think about agility, well, agility is really the ability to sense and make adjustments, right? It's both. You have to be able to see what are the things coming at me and then be able to process them and make adjustments. Well, really, that in a business context is the ability to see what the future is, define what the future is, and then be able to make change happen. And it's the combination of those two core attributes, speed and agility, that I think really build the organization of the future. Satya Nadella, the CEO of Microsoft, says, has a quote that this industry doesn't respect tradition, this industry only respects innovation. And he's talking about the technology industry. But I think that mindset is true in every industry today, which is tradition is becoming much less important. It's the ability to innovate becomes a vital component for an organization that wants to survive over the long term. And again, so many companies, they are on the journey or they have attained operational excellence, but what they're not good at is systematic innovation, that agility gene. And you have to marry those two together. They are not optional as separates. They actually feed into each other really well, but you do need both, to compete really effectively in this era.
How can I see the future, John? How can I develop that agility? How can I look into the future, know what's coming? You said, yet it's uncertain. We can't actually see it. What's the skill set or the practice set to do that?
Well, I think the underlying principle around it is about being curious, right? And so being curious about, like, you know, why does this happen? Why did that happen? Why would do this mistake? And I think in particular, paying attention to your customers and not in a trivial way, not in a proxy way, but truly digging in deep into who your customers are, what their business is, why do they use your product or service, what's beyond your product or service, and especially digging into failures. When you fail to meet customer expectations, when you fail to win a deal, when you fail customer expectations, why did you do that? How can you serve them better? What does their bad day look like? And then figuring out, like, well, how can I serve that unmet need? What problem does my customer have that I could help address? I think that curiosity, first and foremost, is the best method for helping to see the future. But I think that there's more that you can do than just that. I think paying attention to mega trends and the stupid ideas of today that maybe in the future have an impact. And so I think, you know, things like machine learning or digital currencies or other types of scientific advancement well before they're commonplace in your industry. And to do that, one of the ways to do that is, you know, what a lot of big enterprises do is they have a competitive intelligence function. What they typically are doing is paying attention to their peers. And what I would add to that is paying a lot more attention to where early seed venture capital money is going and asking yourself the question, what is it that they must believe in order to make that bet, that investment, make sense to them? And I think that question helps you understand, like, well, this is the bet that they are making. How can that apply to our business? And then again, these are oftentimes wrong ideas, oftentimes too early of ideas. But that's when you want to be curious and you want to be systematic in your education, because then you can identify early on some small bets that you can take in order to really dig deeper, learn it, and figure out, well, this is what's ready for prime time. This isn't what's ready for prime time. This is how we need to prepare for this future. And whether you move early or late, you're well prepared for when it is the right time to step forward bigger on that concept.
One of the mega trends that you mentioned, if I can give it that term, is making things easier. And you say that that's one of the great secrets of digitization for the customer, is making things easier for them. And so if you dig into their world and their experience and you say, boy, they'd like that to be easier, that's one of the great trends to latch onto. Did I catch that exactly right?
Yeah, I mean, I always get asked, like, John, you know, where do we start? And it's like, you know, what are the little pieces of friction that you're asking your customers today to do that would help solve a problem, make it easier for them, right? And I think friction is everywhere, but you see advancement going on against it. And so let me give you an example of, and I just think of things of, like, here's the stuff that frustrates me, you know, and everything, mm-hmm. right? And so think about a big box retailer and, you know, I get the job of like, oh, we've got this really nuanced light bulb that needs to be replaced. I grab that light bulb and I head to my nearest, you know, big box home improvement store. Someplace in that store is this light bulb, right? Think about what the experience is like actually finding that light bulb. So first of all, you have to find the aisle that that light bulb is in. But then secondly, you find the aisle and what are you faced with? You're faced with a wall that is probably 100 by 50 of light bulb options. And so you're up there, you know, I'm in my 50s, my eyesight isn't great. I'm up there trying to find the exact, you know, light bulb and everything, right? That is customer friction. I had an executive once that was at a big box store, and he gave me a stunning statistic. And it was that 50% of the time, a customer with a known need walks into one of their stores. They know the product they want to buy. The product is in the store, but the customer leaves without finding it 50% of the time.
Yep.
And the fact that that it's 2020 and somebody hasn't figured out how to reduce that customer friction, right? Like you still walk in and it's like, you know, the in-store experience at one of these big box stores isn't that much different from 15 to 20 years ago, right?
Hmm. Yep.
So those are the little friction points of the customer experience that I think if I'm struggling with like how to get started, let's attack some small customer friction points. And so go out, talk to your customers, watch your customers, be a customer, pay deep attention to what is it that kind of sucks about the customer experience today? Like, what are the little things we're asking customers to do and how could we do better? And if you do that in a consistent approach, what you'll find is your dissatisfaction just grows. You become more and more frustrated. Like, God, that really, like, it shouldn't be like that. And that is this dissatisfaction with the status quo is one of the seeds for being an innovator.
Yeah, in fact, in our set of theories, John, we talk about customer dissatisfaction as the whole root of innovation and service and entrepreneurship. And we say it's an infinite resource. There's tons of it out there. You've just got to go out and find it and identify it.
You know, Amazon has this, you know, continual habit of taking core capabilities and turning them inside out, having external customers. And the reason why is because external customers are so much more demanding than internal customers, right? So it obviously has the benefit of a great business, but one of the first principles behind why Amazon started this platform strategy was because we realized that internal customers are soft customers. They're not really demanding. We all want to get along. We all want to be, you know, good colleagues together. External customers are, as you said, they're always dissatisfied, right? And those are powerful signals to us in order to innovate and in order to become operationally excellent. And so taking everything you can and figuring out a way, how do I have an external customer that is going to give me those signals of dissatisfaction? That's what true innovators seek out. They don't seek out the platitudes. They seek out the dissatisfaction from their customers because those are the opportunity signals.
Let me shift gears just a little bit, John. And you mentioned a couple of techniques for entrepreneurial efficiency, getting a lot done with less resources. You put that under the general heading of systems thinking in innovation and management, but you mentioned two kind of algorithmic approaches, and tell me if I'm wrong in grouping these together, but I'm going to try. One is other people's work, and you can explain that to us. And the second is the flywheel. So help our entrepreneurs out to be more efficient and more effective through OPW and the flywheel?
Yeah. So again, kind of principles versus mechanisms, right? The principle that OPW, other people's work, helps address is how do you scale work that is inherently unscalable? Scaling at Amazon is a really important management topic and technique. And what it really means at Amazon is being able to do more eaches in your business on an improving economic quantity cost basis for that each. So whether your each is orders or customers or applications or bits, scaling a business means you're able to do more on an improving cost per each. And, you know, there's different techniques for how you scale things, right? Having definition of your processes is really important. Having metrics is really important. Then proceeding on how you automate it. But at some point, there is work that needs to be manual. One of the ways that you can tackle manual work is by giving it to others to do. And that's really the concept of OPW, other people's work. How do we put others to task to do the work, the manual work that our business requires without us always having to scale the workforce? And it's not a technique that's used in every case. It's a limited mechanism. It's got to be used for the right case. But it's been a powerful mechanism for Amazon and lots of other companies. And it's primarily around like, oh, we have a manual thing that needs to be done, quality review, content review, writing descriptions, delivering packages. And instead of hiring all the people to do it, what they do is they build a tool and an incentive engine to get others to do that work for them, to write the quality content, to review the item on the detail page to make sure that it's accurate and appropriately written, to deliver packages for them versus operating all of it. So that's really the concept of OPW, other people's work. Flywheel is really a way of understanding the ecosystem in that you participate in, really articulating what's your theory of change. Like, how do I think this ecosystem works, the powers, the systems dynamic model behind it? And then the other powerful thing that a flywheel model can help do is help communicate your strategy, your view of the world, and what we need to do in order to create a virtuous cycle in our business. And so Amazon has a very famous flywheel, and it's, you know, the customer experience is in the center, and it's all about, by, you know, adding more selection, it helps to decrease, create competition that helps decrease costs. Customers buy more, which brings more customers, which brings more sellers, which then drives the flywheel, right? And helps lower the cost structure. I think that there's more advanced versions of that Amazon flywheel and everything. But I've used that tool to help a team understand truly, like, how does this, especially when you're thinking about an ecosystem, a broadly based system like education or solving a health problem or a health crisis, something that really is a systems dynamic model, and understanding how do these forces and how do these factors play into each other, and then picking, well, where do I make my investment? Where do I make a difference in this flywheel? And how do I create something that is self-feeding, right? It creates momentum, that virtuous cycle. That's really where and when you use a flywheel model, is to help understand that ecosystem, how change happens, and what's your strategy relative to it, and then the ability to effectively communicate it to others.
Well, let's talk about an ecosystem that we're very interested in here, John, and that's the ecosystem for entrepreneurship. And we have this vision of the new era of entrepreneurship. I, listening to you, I'm going to write a narrative for that, and I'm going to write a future press release. But we think of it in multiple dimensions, which is it's an ethic. It's a way for people to get things done, to serve other people, to make the world better, but also to make a profit. It's an ethic. It's a symptom of the, or an outcome of the new interconnectedness. I don't need to be in a big company to connect with all of these resources all over the planet. It's a consequence of new styles of organization. Everybody doesn't have to be an employee. They can be contractors or just suppliers and so on. And it's also a consequence of the new infrastructure, which you built a part of, a big part of, the third-party seller opportunity on Amazon, but also AWS, which means I can get all the computing power I need and buy it by the minute. So you've been deep in this. You've talked about being digital. What do you think about this idea that in the future we're going to have more and more people being entrepreneurs? That might be small or medium-sized companies. It might be new forms we can't even think of. But the world's going to be more entrepreneurial and less institutionalized and less kind of big company dominant. What do you think about that?
I definitely think that the ability to innovate faster on a more systematic basis is going to become much more a core of what being a business means. And so that's going to be spread across the entire continuum of industries and company types and company sizes and all of that. I actually am fearful that big companies are now so powerful, meaning the resources that they have, that they're able to acquire small companies before those ideas can really create the full company that it can become. And so I think that there is some risk that small company entrepreneurship is at risk because of the resources and the acquisition appetite of large companies. And so I think that there are some things that we need to think about as a society and as a country to make sure that small company entrepreneurship is as much of a force in shaping the future as it has been that's created these very large and powerful, meaning like resources that are hard to imagine companies. And that would be my only kind of counter or add to, I think, the theory that you have.
Yeah, I hear you there. I wonder whether those big companies like an Amazon become kind of infrastructure for the small companies.
Yeah, so certainly on one hand, that's very true today, you know, and everything, right? Like the ability to test, launch, scale something because of cloud computing is 100 times easier than it was 20 years ago, right? Like no doubt. But there is the other side of it, which is a very acquisitive culture across all of these companies. And whether it's just a good idea or it's a competitive idea, I think that there is the risk that the future competitiveness is hampered because of the resources of very large companies.
Let's leave it there for today, John. I'm going to work on my narrative and my future press release.
I hope I get to read it and to learn from it.
Well, maybe you can come back and help us with it.
That'd be fantastic. I'd love to do that.
John, you've given us so much to think about, so much advice, so much to absorb. We'll do our best to do that, but we hope that we will be able to invite you back in the future. I will link to your book on the website. Is there another place where people can find John Rossman on the internet?
Should they? You know, probably the best place is LinkedIn. You know, John Rossman. That's kind of the command center for connecting with people. And you know, the favor I ask is if anybody buys and reads or listens to Think Like Amazon, I appreciate an authentic review left at Amazon.
Very good. I personally will do that, and I'm sure many other people will too. I recommend the book to everyone. So I. there's so much you can get out of it and keep getting out of it as you keep going back to it. So, John?
I'd love to hear about how people have taken a couple of these ideas and put them into work in their team and in their organization. I love to hear those stories.
Let us see if we can generate some feedback. I will cool. attempt to do that.
Okay.
John, thank you very much. I look forward to the next time.
Hunter, have a great day.
Economics for Entrepreneurs is a production of the Mises Institute. To explore more content like this, visit Mises.org. That's Mises.org. For more from Hunter Hastings, check out HunterHastings.com.